The men from the crime lab pulled the zippers shut on the body bags. It was a cold sound that hung for a moment, like a chain of icicles in the hot July air. Deputy Bachner said, "At first we thought Trankin was probably knifed by some psycho. Once in a while you get a homicidal nut who prowls these forests instead of the streets, preying on hikers. So we figured, knifed first, then all this other damage must have been done by animals, scavengers, after the guy was dead. But now, we're not so sure."
"I don't see blood on the ground here," Cliff Soames said with a note of puzzlement. "There'd have been a lot of it."
"They weren't killed here," Deputy Bachner said, then went on with his summary at his own pace. "Female, 27, Ruth Cassavaris, also of Glendale. Also vicious bite marks, slashes. Her throat..."
Cutting him off again, Lem said, "When were they killed?"
"Best guess before lab tests that they died late yesterday. We believe the bodies were carried up here because they'd be found quicker on the ridgetop. A popular hiking trail runs along here. But it wasn't other hikers who found them. It was a routine fire patrol plane. Pilot looked down, saw them sprawled here on the bare ridge."
This high ground above Boulder Canyon was more than 30 air miles north-northwest of Johnstone Peak, where the young campers had taken refuge from the outsider in their van and had later fired at it with a .32 pistol on June 18th, 28 days ago. The outsider would have been reckoning north-northwest by sheer instinct, and no doubt would have frequently been required to backtrack out of box canyons. Therefore, in this mountainous terrain, it had very likely traveled between 60 and 90 miles on the ground to cover those 30 air miles. Still, that was only a pace of 3 miles a day, at most, and Lem wondered what the creature had been doing during the time it was not traveling or sleeping, or chasing down food.
"You'll want to see where these two were killed," Bachner said. "We found the place, and you'll want to see the den, too."
"Den?"
"The lair,"
one of the forest rangers said.
"The damn lair."
The deputies, rangers, and crime lab men had been giving Lem and Cliff odd looks ever since they had arrived. But Lem had not been surprised by that. Local authorities always regarded him with suspicion and curiosity, because they were not accustomed to having a powerhouse federal agency like the NSA show up and claim jurisdiction. It was a rarity. But now he realized that their curiosity was of a different kind and degree than what he usually encountered. And for the first time, he perceived their fear. They had found something, the lair of which they spoke, that gave them reason to believe this case was even stranger than the sudden appearance of the NSA would usually indicate. In suits, ties, and polished street shoes, neither Lem nor Cliff was properly dressed for a hike down into the canyon. But neither of them hesitated when the rangers led the way. Two deputies, the lab men, and one of the three rangers remained behind with the bodies, which left a party of six for the descent. They followed a shallow channel carved by runoff from rainstorms, then switched to what might have been a deer trail. After descending to the very bottom of the canyon, they turned southeast and proceeded for half a mile. Soon Lem was sweaty and covered with a film of dust, and his socks and pant legs were full of prickling burrs.
"Here's where they were killed," Deputy Bachner said when he led them into a clearing surrounded by scrub pines, cottonwoods, and brush.
The pale, sandy earth and sun-bleached grass were mottled with enormous dark stains. Blood.
"And right back here,"
one of the rangers said, "is where we found the lair."
It was a shallow cave in the base of the canyon wall, perhaps 10 feet deep, 20 feet wide, no more than a dozen steps from the small clearing where the hikers had been murdered. The mouth of the cave was about 8 feet wide but low, requiring Lem to stoop a bit as he entered. Once inside, he was able to stand erect, for the ceiling was high. The place had a mildly unpleasant, musty smell. Light found its way through the entrance, and through a 2-foot-wide water-carved hole in the ceiling, but for the most part the chamber was shadowy and 20 degrees cooler than the canyon outside. Only Deputy Bachner accompanied Lem and Cliff. Lem sensed that the others held back not out of any concern that the cave would be too crowded, but out of an uneasiness about the place. Bachner had a flashlight. He switched it on and played the beam over the things he had brought them to see, dispelling some of the shadows and causing others to flit bat-like across the room to roost on different perches.
In one corner, dry grass had been piled to a depth of 6 or 8 inches to make a bed on the sandstone floor. Beside the bed was a galvanized bucket full of relatively fresh water, carried from the nearest stream, evidently placed there so the sleeper could get a drink upon waking in the middle of the night.
"It was here," Cliff said softly.
"Yes," Lem agreed.
Instinctively, he sensed the outsider had made this bed. Somehow its alien presence was still in the chamber. He stared at the bucket, wondering where the creature had acquired it. Most likely along the way from Banodyne, it had decided it would eventually find a burrow and hide for a while, and it had realized it would need a few things to make its life in the wild more comfortable. Perhaps breaking into a stable or barn or empty house, it had stolen the bucket and various other things that Bachner now revealed with his flashlight. A plaid flannel blanket for when the weather turned cooler. A horse blanket, judging by the look of it. What caught Lem's attention was the neatness with which the blanket had been folded and placed on a narrow ledge in the wall beside the entrance. A flashlight. This was on the same shelf that held the blanket. The outsider had exceedingly good night vision. That was one of the design requirements with which Dr. Yarbeck had been working. In the dark, a good genetically engineered warrior would be able to see as well as a cat. So why would it want the flashlight? Unless... maybe even a creature of the night was sometimes afraid of darkness. That thought jolted Lem, and suddenly he pitied the beast as he had pitied it that day he had watched it communicating by crude sign language with Yarbeck. The day it had said that it wanted to tear its own eyes out so it would never have to look at itself again. Bachner moved the beam of his own flashlight and focused it on 20 candy wrappers. Apparently, the outsider had stolen a couple family packs of candy somewhere along the way. The strange thing was that the wrappers were not crumpled, but were smoothed out and laid flat on the floor along the back wall. 10 from Reese's peanut butter cups and 10 from Clark bars. Perhaps the outsider liked the bright colors of the wrappers. Or perhaps it kept them to remind itself of the pleasure that the candy had given it. Because once those treats were gone, there was not much other pleasure to be had in the hard life to which it had been driven. In the farthest corner from the bed, deep in the shadows, was a pile of bones. The bones of small animals. Once the candy was eaten, the outsider had been forced to hunt in order to feed itself. And without the means to light a fire, it had fed savagely on raw meat. Perhaps it kept the bones in the cave because it was afraid that, by disposing of them outside, it would be leaving clues to its whereabouts. By storing them in the darkest, farthest corner of its haven, it seemed to have a civilized sense of neatness and order. But to Lem it also seemed as if the outsider had hidden the bones in the shadows because it was ashamed of its own savagery. Most pathetically of all, a peculiar group of items was stored in a niche in the wall above the grassy bed. No, Lem decided. Not just stored. The items were carefully arranged, as if for display, the way an aficionado of art glass or ceramics or Mayan pottery might display a valuable collection. There was a round stained glass bauble of the sort that people hung from their patio covers to sparkle in the sun. It was about 4 inches in diameter, and it portrayed a blue flower against a pale yellow background. Beside that bauble was a bright copper pot that had probably once contained a plant on the same or another patio. Next to the pot were two things that surely had been taken from inside a house, perhaps from the same place where the outsider had stolen the candy. First, a fine porcelain study of a pair of red-feathered cardinals sitting on a branch, every detail exquisitely crafted. Second, a crystal paperweight. Apparently, even within the alien beast of Yarbeck's monstrosity, there was an appreciation of beauty and a desire to live not as an animal, but as a thinking being in an ambience at least lightly touched by civilization. Lem felt sick at heart as he considered the lonely, tortured, self-hating, inhuman yet self-aware creature that Yarbeck had brought into the world. Last of all, the niche above the grass bed held a 10-inch-high figure of Mickey Mouse that was also a coin bank. Lem's pity swelled because he knew why the bank had appealed to the outsider. At Banodyne, there had been experiments to determine the depth and nature of the dogs and the outsider's intelligence, to discover how close their perceptions were to those of a human being. One of the experiments had been designed to probe their ability to differentiate between fantasy and reality. On several occasions, the dog and the outsider had separately been shown a videotape that had been assembled from film clips of all kinds, bits of old John Wayne movies, footage from George Lucas's Star Wars, news films, scenes from a wide variety of documentaries, and old Mickey Mouse cartoons. The reactions of the dog and the outsider were filmed, and later they were quizzed to see if they understood which segments of the videotape were of real events and which were flights of the imagination. Both creatures had gradually learned to identify fantasy when they saw it. But strangely, the one fantasy they most wanted to believe in, the fantasy they clung to the longest, was Mickey Mouse. They were enthralled by Mickey's adventures with his cartoon friends. After escaping Banodyne, the outsider had somehow come across this coin bank, and had wanted it badly, because the poor damn thing was reminded of the only real pleasure it had ever known while in the lab. In the beam of Deputy Bachner's flashlight, something on the shelf glinted. It was lying nearly flat beside the coin bank, and they almost overlooked it. Cliff stepped onto the grass bed, and plucked the gleaming object out of the wall niche. A 3-inch by 4-inch triangular fragment of a mirror. The outsider huddled here, Lem thought, trying to take heart from its meager treasures, trying to make as much of a home for itself as was possible. Once in a while it picked up this jagged shard from a mirror and stared at itself, perhaps searching hopefully for an aspect of its countenance that was not ugly, perhaps trying to come to terms with what it was, and failing, surely failing. "Dear God," Cliff Soane said quietly, for the same thoughts had apparently passed through his mind. "The poor miserable bastard." The outsider had possessed one additional item, a copy of People magazine. Robert Redford was on the cover. With a claw, sharp stone, or some other instrument, the outsider had cut out Redford's eyes. The magazine was rumpled and tattered, as if it had been paged through 100 times, and now Deputy Bachner handed it to them and suggested they page through it once more. On doing so, Lem saw that the eyes of every person pictured in the issue had been either scratched, cut, or crudely torn out. The thoroughness of this symbolic mutilation, not one image in the magazine had been spared, was chilling. The outsider was pathetic, yes, and it was to be pitied. But it was also to be feared. 5 victims, some gutted, some decapitated. The innocent dead must not be forgotten, not for a moment. Neither an affection for Mickey Mouse nor a love of beauty could excuse such slaughter. But Jesus! The creature had been given sufficient intelligence to grasp the importance and the benefits of civilization, to long for acceptance and a meaningful existence. Yet a fierce lust for violence, a killing instinct second to none in nature, was also engineered into it because it was meant to be a smart killer on a long invisible leash, a living machine of war. No matter how long it existed in peaceful solitude in its canyon cave, no matter how many days or weeks it resisted its own violent urges, it could not change what it was. The pressure would build within it until it could no longer contain itself, until the slaughter of small animals would not provide enough psychological relief, and then it would seek larger and more interesting prey. It might damn itself for its savagery, might long to remake itself into a creature that could exist in harmony with the rest of the world, but it was powerless to change what it was. Only hours ago, Lem had pondered how difficult it was for him to become a different man from the one his father had raised. How hard it was for any man to change what life had made him, but at least it was possible if one had the determination, willpower, and time. However, for the outsider, change was impossible. Murder was in the beast's genes, locked in, and it could expect no hope of recreation or salvation. What the hell is this all about? Deputy Bachner asked, finally unable to repress his curiosity.
Believe me, Lem said. You don't want to know.
What was in this cave? Bachner asked.
Lem only shook his head. If two more people had to die, it was a stroke of good fortune that they'd been murdered in a national forest. This was federal land, which meant much simpler procedures by which the NSA could assume authority in the investigation.
Cliff Soames was still turning the fragment of mirror over and over in his hand, staring at it thoughtfully. Looking around the eerie chamber one last time, Lem Johnson made a promise to himself and to his dangerous quarry. When I find you, I won't consider trying to take you alive. No net or tranquilizer guns, as the scientists and the military types would prefer. Instead, I'll shoot you quick and clean. Take you down fast.
That was not only the safest plan. It would also be an act of compassion and mercy.
Part 4. By the 1st of August, Nora sold all of Aunt Violet's furniture and other possessions. She had phoned a man who dealt in antiques and second-hand furniture, and he had given her one price for everything, and she had accepted it happily. Now, except for dishes, silverware, and the furniture in the bedroom that she had made her own, the rooms were empty from wall to wall. The house seemed cleansed, purified, exorcised. All evil spirits had been driven out, and she knew she now had the will to redecorate entirely. But she no longer wanted the place, so she telephoned a real estate agent and put it on the market. Her old clothes were gone too, all of them, and she had an entirely new wardrobe, with slacks and skirts and blouses and jeans and dresses like any woman might have. Occasionally she felt too conspicuous in bright clothes, but she always resisted the urge to change into something dark and drab. She still had not found the courage to put her artistic talent on the market and see if her work was worth anything. Travis nudged her about it now and then, in ways he thought were subtle, but she was not ready to lay her fragile ego on the anvil and give just anyone a chance to swing a hammer at it. Soon, but not yet. Sometimes when she looked at herself in a mirror or noticed a reflection in a sun-silvered store window, she realized that indeed she was pretty. Not beautiful, perhaps, not gorgeous like some movie star, but moderately pretty. However, she did not seem to be able to hold on to this breakthrough perception of her appearance, at least not for long, because every few days she would be surprised anew by the comeliness of the face looking back at her from the mirror. On the 5th of August, late in the afternoon, she and Travis were sitting at the table in his kitchen playing Scrabble, and she was feeling pretty. A few minutes ago in the bathroom, she'd had another of those revelations when she had looked in the mirror, and in fact, she had liked her looks more than ever before. Now back at the Scrabble board, she felt buoyant, happier than she would have once believed possible, and mischievous. She started using her tiles to spell nonsense words, and then vociferously defended them when Travis questioned their legitimacy.
Dofnup, he said, frowning at the board.
There's no such word as Dofnup. It's a triangular cap that loggers wear, she said.
Loggers?
Like Paul Bunyan. Loggers wear knit caps, what you call toboggan caps, or round leather caps with ear flaps. I'm not talking about what they wear to work in the woods, she explained patiently. Dofnup, that's the name of the cap they wear to bed. He laughed and shook his head. Are you putting me on? She kept a straight face. No, it's true. Loggers wear a special cap to bed. Yes, the Dofnup. He was unaccustomed to the very idea that Nora would play a joke on him, so he fell for it.
Dofnup? Why do they call it that?
Beats me, she said. Einstein was on the floor, on his belly, reading a novel. Since graduating with startling swiftness from picture books to children's literature like The Wind in the Willows, he had been reading 8 and 10 hours a day, every day. He couldn't get enough books. He'd become a prose junkie. 10 days ago, when the dog's obsession with reading had finally outstripped Nora's patience for holding books and turning pages, they had tried to puzzle out an arrangement that would make it possible for Einstein to keep a volume open in front of him and turn the pages himself. At a hospital supply company, they'd found a device designed for patients who had the use of neither arms nor legs. There was a metal stand onto which the boards of the book were clamped. Electrically powered mechanical arms, controlled by 3 push buttons, turned the pages and held them in place. A quadriplegic could operate it with a stylus held in his teeth. Einstein used his nose. The dog seemed immensely pleased by the arrangement. Now he whimpered softly about something he had just read, pushed one of the buttons, and turned another page. Travis spelled wicked and picked up a lot of points by using a double score square, so Nora used her tiles to spell herky, which was worth even more points. Herky? Travis said doubtfully. It's a favorite Yugoslavian meal, she said. It is? Yes. The recipe includes both ham and turkey, which is why they call it... She couldn't finish. She broke into laughter. He gaped at her in astonishment. You are putting me on. You are putting me on. Nora Devon, what's become of you? When I first met you, I said to myself, now there's the grimmest, damn, most serious young woman I've ever seen. And squirrely... Well, not squirrely. Yes, squirrely, she insisted. You thought I was squirrely. All right, yeah, I thought you were so squirrely, you probably had the attic of that house packed full of walnuts. Grinning, she said, if Violet and I had lived in the South, we'd have been straight out of Faulkner, wouldn't we? Too weird, even for Faulkner. But now, just look at you. Making up dumb words and dumber jokes, conning me into believing them because I'd never expect Nora Devon, of all people, to do any such thing. You've sure changed in these few months. Thanks to you, she said. Maybe thanks to Einstein more than me. No. You most of all, she said. And abruptly she was stricken by that old shyness that had once all but paralyzed her. She looked away from him, down at her tray of Scrabble tiles, and in a low voice she said, you most of all. I'd never have met Einstein if I hadn't met you. And you cared about me, worried about me, saw something in me that I couldn't see. You remade me. No, he said. You give me too much credit. You didn't have to be remade. This Nora was always there, inside the old one, like a flower all cramped up and hidden inside a drab little seed. You just had to be encouraged to, well, to grow and bloom. She could not look at him. She felt as if a tremendous stone had been placed on the back of her neck, forcing her to bow her head, and she was blushing. But she found the courage to say, it's so damn hard to bloom, to change. Even when you want to change, want it more than anything in the world, it's hard. Desire to change isn't enough, or desperation. Couldn't be done without love. Her voice had dropped to a whisper, and she was unable to lift it. Love is like the water and the sun that make the seed grow. He said, Nora, look at me. That stone on her neck must have weighed 100 pounds, 1,000. Nora, it weighed a ton. Nora, I love you too. Somehow, with great effort, she lifted her head. She looked at him. His brown eyes, so dark as to be almost black, were warm and kind and beautiful. She loved those eyes. She loved the high bridge and narrow line of his nose. She loved every aspect of his lean and ascetic face. I should have told you first, he said, because it's easier for me to say it than it is for you. I should have said it days ago, weeks ago. Nora, by God, I love you. But I didn't say it because I was afraid. Every time I let myself love someone, I lose them. But this time I think maybe it'll be different. Maybe you'll change things for me the way I helped change them for you. And maybe this time luck's with me. Her heart raced. She could barely get her breath, but she said, I love you. Will you marry me? She was stunned. She did not know what she'd expected to happen, but certainly not this. Just hearing him say he loved her, just being able to express the same sentiments to him, that was enough to keep her happy for weeks, months. She expected to have time to walk around their love, as if it were a great and mysterious edifice that, like some newly discovered pyramid, must be studied and pondered from every angle before she dared to undertake an exploration of the interior. Will you marry me? He repeated. This was too fast, recklessly fast. And just sitting there on a kitchen chair, she got as dizzy as if she'd been spinning around on a carnival ride. And she was afraid, too. So she tried to tell him to slow down, tried to tell him they had plenty of time to consider the next step before taking it. But to her surprise, she heard herself say, "Yes, oh, yes." He reached out and took both her hands. She cried then, but they were good tears. Lost in his book, Einstein had nevertheless been aware of what was transpiring. He came to the table, sniffing at both of them, rubbing against their legs, and whining happily. Travis said, "Next week? Married? But it takes time to get a license and everything. Not in Las Vegas. I can call ahead, make arrangements with a wedding chapel in Vegas. We can go next week and be married." Crying and laughing at the same time, she said, "All right. Terrific," Travis said, grinning. Einstein wagged his tail furiously. "Yes, yes, 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 yes." Part 5. On Wednesday, the 4th of August, working on contract for the Tetragna family of San Francisco, Vince Nasco hit a little cockroach named Lou Pantangela. The cockroach had turned state's evidence and was scheduled in September to testify in court against members of the Tetragna organization. Johnny the Wire Santini, computer hacker for the mob, had used his high-tech expertise to invade federal computer files and locate Pantangela. The cockroach was living under the protection of two federal marshals in a safe house in, of all places, Redondo Beach, south of L.A. After testifying this autumn, he was scheduled to be given a new identity and a new life in Connecticut. But, of course, he was not going to live that long. Because Vince would probably have to waste one or both of the marshals to get at Pantangela, the rub-out was going to bring a lot of heat. So the Tetragnas offered him a very high price, $60,000. They had no way of knowing that the need to kill more than one man was a bonus to Vince. It made the job more, not less, attractive. He ran surveillance on Pantangela for almost a week, using a different vehicle every day to avoid being spotted by the cockroach's bodyguards. They did not often let Pantangela outside, but they were still more confident of their hiding place than they should have been, because three or four times a week they allowed him to have a late lunch in public, accompanying him to a little trattoria 4 blocks from the safe house. They changed Pantangela's appearance as much as possible. He had once had thick black hair that he had worn longish over his collar. Now his hair was cut short and dyed light brown. He'd had a mustache, but they'd made him shave it off. He'd been 60 pounds overweight, but after 2 months in the care of the marshals, he had lost about 40 pounds. Nevertheless, Vince recognized him. On Wednesday, August 4th, they took Pantangela to the trattoria at 1 o'clock as usual. At 1:10, Vince strolled in to have his own lunch. The restaurant had only 8 tables in the middle and 6 booths along each sidewall. It looked clean, but had too much Italian kitsch for Vince's taste. Red and white checkered tablecloths, garish murals of Roman ruins, empty wine bottles used as candle holders, 1,000 bunches of plastic grapes, for God's sake, hanging from lattice fixed to the ceiling and meant to convey the atmosphere of an arbor. Because Californians tend to eat an early dinner, at least by Eastern standards, they also eat an early lunch. And by 1:10, the number of diners had already peaked and was declining. By 2 o'clock, it was likely that the only customers remaining would be Pantangela, his 2 bodyguards, and Vince, which was what made it such a good place for the hit. The trattoria was too small to bother with a hostess at lunch, and a sign told guests to seat themselves. Vince walked back through the room, past the Pantangela party, to an empty booth behind them. Vince had given a lot of thought to his clothes. He was wearing rope sandals, red cotton shorts, and a white t-shirt on which were blue waves, a yellow sun, and the words, "Another California Body." His aviator sunglasses were mirrored. He carried an open-topped canvas beach bag that was boldly lettered, "My Stuff." If you glanced in the bag when he walked past, you'd see a tightly rolled towel, bottles of tanning lotion, a small radio, and a hairbrush. But you wouldn't see the fully automatic, silencer-equipped Uzi pistol with a 40-round magazine hidden in the bottom. With his deep tan to complement the outfit, he achieved the look he wanted. A very fit but aging surfer. A leisure-sodded, shiftless, and probably harebrained jerk who would be beaching it every day, pretending to be young, and still self-intoxicated when he was 60. He only glanced uninterestedly at Pentangela and the marshals, but he was aware of them giving him the once-over, then dismissing him as harmless. Perfect. The booths had high, padded backs, so from where he sat he could not see Pentangela. But he could hear the cockroach and the marshals talking now and then, mostly about baseball and women. After a week of surveillance, Vince knew that Pentangela never left the trattoria sooner than 2:30, usually 3 o'clock, evidently because he insisted on an appetizer, a salad, a main course, and dessert, the whole works. That gave Vince the time for a salad and an order of linguine with clam sauce. His waitress was about 20, white blonde, pretty, and as deeply tanned as Vince. She had the hip look and sound of a beach girl, and she started coming on to him right away while taking his order. He figured she was one of those sand nymphs whose brain was as sun-fried as her body. She probably spent every summer evening on the beach, doing dope of every description, spreading her legs for any stud who vaguely interested her, and most of them would interest her, which meant that no matter how healthy she looked, she was disease-ridden. Just the idea of humping her made him want to puke, but he had to play out the role he'd chosen for himself, so he flirted with her and tried to look as if he could barely keep from drooling at the thought of her naked, writhing body pinned under him. At 2:05, Vince had finished lunch, and the only other customers in the place were Pentangela and the two marshals. One of the waitresses had left for the day, and the other two were in the kitchen. It could not have been better. The beach bag was on the booth beside him. He reached into it and withdrew the Uzi pistol. Pentangela and the marshals were talking about the Dodgers' chances of getting in the World Series. Vince got up, stepped around to their booth, and sprayed them with 20 to 30 rounds from the Uzi. The stubby high-tech silencer worked beautifully, and the shot sounded like nothing more than a stuttering man having trouble pronouncing a word that began with a sibilant. It went down so fast that the marshals didn't have a chance to reach for their own weapons. They didn't even have time to be surprised. Snap, snap, snap. Pentangela and his guardians were dead in 3 seconds. Vince shuddered with intense pleasure and was briefly overcome by the wealth of life energy that he had just absorbed. He could not speak. Then in a tremulous and raspy voice he said, "Thank you." When he turned away from the booth, he saw his waitress standing in the middle of the room, frozen in shock. Her wide blue eyes were fixated on the dead men. But now her gaze shifted slowly to Vince. Before she could scream, he emptied the rest of the magazine into her, maybe 10 shots, and she went down in a rain of blood. Snap! "Thank you," he said, then said it again, because she had been young and vital, and therefore of more use to him. Concerned that someone else would come out of the kitchen, or maybe someone would walk past the restaurant and look in and see the waitress on the floor, Vince stepped quickly to his booth, snatched up the beach bag, and jammed the Uzi pistol under the towel. Putting on his mirrored sunglasses, he got out of there. He was not worried about fingerprints. He had coated the pads of his fingers with Elmer's glue. It dried nearly transparent and could not be noticed unless he turned his hands palms up and called people's attention to it. The layer of glue was thick enough to fill the minute lines in the skin, leaving the fingertips smooth. Outside, he walked to the end of the block, turned the corner, and got into his van, which was parked at the curb. As far as he could tell, no one gave him a second look. He went to the ocean, looking forward to some time in the sun and an invigorating swim. Going to Redondo Beach 2 blocks away seemed too bold, so he followed the coast highway south to Bolsa Chica, just north of where he lived in Huntington Beach. As he drove, he thought about the dog. He was still paying Johnny the Wire to keep tabs on animal pounds, police agencies, and anyone else who might be dragged into the search for the retriever. He knew about the National Security Agency's bulletin to veterinarians and animal control authorities in 3 states, and he also knew that the NSA had so far had no luck. Maybe the dog had been killed by a car, or by the creature that Hudson had called the Outsider, or by a coyote pack in the hills. But Vince didn't want to believe it was dead, because that would mean an end to his dream of making a huge financial killing with the dog, either by ransoming it back to the authorities, or selling it to a rich showbiz type who could work up an act with it, or by finding some means of using the animal's secret intelligence to pull a safe and profitable scam on unsuspecting Marks. What he preferred to believe was that someone had found the dog and had taken it home as a pet. If he could just locate the people who had the dog, he could buy it from them, or blow them away and just take the mutt. But where the hell was he supposed to look? How was he supposed to find them? If they were findable, the NSA would surely reach them first. Most likely, if the dog was not already dead, the best way to get his hands on it was to find the outsider first and let that beast lead him to the dog, which Hudson had seemed to think it would. But that was not an easy task either. Johnny the Wire was also still providing him with information about particularly violent killings of people and animals throughout Southern California. Vince knew about the slaughter at the Irvine Park Petting Zoo, the murder of Wes Dahlberg, and the men at Bordeaux Ridge. Johnny had turned up the rash of reports about mutilated pets in the Diamond Bar area, and Vince had actually seen the TV news story about the young couple who had encountered what they thought was an extraterrestrial in the wilds below Johnstone Peak. 3 weeks ago, two hikers had been found horribly mauled in the Angeles National Forest. By hacking his way into the NSA's own computers, Johnny had confirmed that they had taken over jurisdiction in that case, too, which meant it had to be the work of the outsider. Since then, nothing. Vince was not ready to give up, not by a long shot. He was a patient man. Patience was part of his job. He would wait, watch, keep Johnny the Wire at work, and sooner or later he would get what he was after. He was sure of it. He had decided that the dog, like immortality, was part of his great destiny. At Bolsa Chica State Beach, he stood for a while with the surf pounding against his thighs, staring out at the great dark masses of surging water. He felt as powerful as the sea. He was filled with scores of lives. He would not have been surprised if electricity had suddenly leaped from his fingertips the way thunderbolts flashed from the hands of the gods in mythology. Finally, he threw himself forward, into the water, and swam against the powerful incoming waves. He went far out before turning parallel to the shore, swimming fast south and then north, keeping at it until exhausted, he at last allowed the tide to carry him back to shore. He dozed for a while in the hot afternoon sun. He dreamed of a pregnant woman, her stomach large and round, and in the dream, he strangled her to death. He often dreamed of killing children, or even better, the unborn children of pregnant women, because it was something he longed to do in real life. Child murder was, of course, much too dangerous. It was a pleasure he had to deny himself, though a child's life energy would be the richest, the purest, the most worthy of absorption. Too dangerous by far. He couldn't indulge in infanticide until he was certain he had achieved immortality, whereupon he would no longer need to fear the police or anyone else. Although he often had such dreams, the one he woke from on Bolsa Chica Beach struck him as more meaningful than others of its type. It felt different, prophetic. He sat yawning and blinking in the westering sun, pretending not to notice the bikinied girls who were giving him the eye, and he told himself that this dream was a glimpse of pleasure to come. One day he would actually feel his hands around the throat of a pregnant woman like the one in the dream, and he would know the ultimate thrill, receive the ultimate gift, not only her life energy, but the pure, untapped energy of the unborn in her womb. Feeling like $1 million, he returned to his van, drove home, showered, and went out to dinner at the nearest Stuart Anderson steakhouse, where he treated himself to filet mignon. Part 6. Einstein bolted past Travis, out of the kitchen, across the small dining room, disappearing into the living room. Carrying the leash, Travis went after him. Einstein was hiding behind the sofa. Travis said, "Listen, it's not going to hurt." The dog watched him warily. "We've got to take care of this before we go off to Vegas. The vet will give you a couple of shots, vaccinate you against distemper and rabies. It's for your own good, and it really won't hurt, really." Then we'll get you a license, which we should have done weeks ago.
One bark.
No.
Yes, we will.
No.
Crouching, holding the leash by the clip with which he would attach it to the collar, Travis took a step toward Einstein. The retriever scrambled away. He ran to the armchair, leaped up, and stood on that observation platform, watching Travis intently. Coming slowly out from behind the sofa, Travis said,
"Now you listen up, Furface. I'm your master."
One bark. Frowning, Travis said,
"Oh yes, I am your master. You may be one damn smart dog, but you're still the dog and I'm the man, and I'm telling you that we're going to the vet."
One bark. Leaning against the dining room archway, arms folded, smiling, Nora said,
"I think he's trying to give you a taste of what children are like, in case we ever decide to have any."
Travis lunged toward the dog. Einstein flew off his perch and was already out of the room when Travis, unable to halt, fell over the armchair. Laughing, Nora said, "This is vastly entertaining."
"Where'd he go?"
Travis demanded. She pointed to the hallway that led to the two bedrooms and bath. He found the retriever in the master bedroom, standing on the bed facing the doorway.
"You can't win," Travis said. "This is for your own good, damn it. And you're going to have those shots, whether you like it or not."
Einstein lifted one hind leg and peed on the bed. Astonished, Travis said,
"What in the hell are you doing?"
Einstein stopped peeing, stepped away from the puddle that was soaking into the quilted bedspread, and stared defiantly at Travis. Travis had heard stories of dogs and cats expressing extreme displeasure by stunts like this. When he had owned the real estate agency, one of his saleswomen had boarded her miniature collie in a kennel for 2 weeks while away on vacation. When she returned and bailed out the dog, it punished her by urinating on both her favorite chair and her bed. But Einstein was not an ordinary dog. Considering his remarkable intellect, the soiling of the bed was even more of an outrage than it would have been if he had been ordinary. Getting angry now, moving toward the dog, Travis said,
"This is inexcusable!"
Einstein scrambled off the mattress. Realizing the dog would try to slip around him and out of the room, Travis scuttled backward and slammed the door. Cut off from the exit, Einstein swiftly changed directions and dashed to the far end of the bedroom, where he stood in front of the dresser.
"No more fooling around,"
Travis said sternly, brandishing the leash. Einstein retreated into a corner. Closing in at a crouch, spreading his arms to prevent the dog from bolting around either side of him, Travis finally made contact and clipped the leash to the collar.
"Ha!"
Huddled defeatedly in the corner, Einstein hung his head and began to shudder. Travis's sense of triumph was short-lived. He stared in dismay at the dog's bowed and trembling head, at the visible shivers that shook the animal's flanks. Einstein issued low, almost inaudible, pathetic whines of fear. Stroking the dog, trying to calm and reassure him, Travis said, "This really is for your own good, you know. Distemper, rabies, the sort of stuff you don't want to mess with. And it'll be painless, my friend. I swear it will." The dog would not look at him and refused to take heart from his assurances. Under Travis's hand, the dog felt as if he were shaking himself to pieces. He stared hard at the retriever, thinking, then said, "In that lab, did they put a lot of needles in you? Did they hurt you with needles? Is that why you're afraid of getting vaccinations?" Einstein only whimpered. Travis pulled the reluctant dog out of the corner, freeing his tail for a question-and-answer session. Dropping the leash, he took Einstein's head in both hands and forced his face up so they were eye to eye. "Did they hurt you with needles in the lab?"
"Yes."
"Is that why you're afraid of the vet?" Though he did not stop shuddering, the dog barked once.
"No."
"You were hurt by needles, but you're not afraid of them?"
"No."
"Then why are you like this?" Einstein just stared at him and made those terrible sounds of distress. Nora opened the bedroom door a crack and peeked in.
"Did you get the leash on him yet, Einstein?"
Then she said, "Phew, what happened in here?" Still holding the dog's head, staring into his eyes, Travis said, "He made a bold statement of displeasure."
"Bold?"
she agreed, moving to the bed and beginning to strip off the soiled spread, blanket, and sheets. Trying to puzzle out the reason for the dog's behavior, Travis said,
Einstein, if it's not needles you're afraid of, is it the vet?
One bark.
No.
Frustrated, Travis brooded on his next question while Nora pulled the mattress cover from the bed. Einstein trembled. Suddenly, Travis had a flash of understanding that illuminated the dog's contrariness and fear. He cursed his own thick-headedness.
Hell, of course! You're not afraid of the vet! But of who the vet might report you to!
Einstein's shivering subsided a bit, and he wagged his tail briefly.
Yes. If people from that lab are hunting for you, and we know they must be hunting furiously because you have to be the most important experimental animal in history, then they're going to be in touch with every vet in the state, aren't they? Every vet, and every dog pound, and every dog licensing agency.
Another burst of vigorous tail wagging, less shivering. Nora came around the bed and stooped down beside Travis.
The golden retrievers have to be one of the two or three most popular breeds. Vets and animal licensing bureaucrats deal with them all the time. If our genius dog here hides his light under a bushel and plays dopey mutt, which he can do quite well, then they'd have no way of knowing he was the fugitive.
Yes, Einstein insisted.
To the dog, Travis said, "What do you mean? Are you saying they would be able to identify you?"
"Yes."
"How?"
Nora wondered.
Travis said, "A mark of some kind?"
"Yes."
"Somewhere under all that fur?"
Nora asked.
"One bark."
"No."
"Then where?" Travis wondered. Pulling loose of Travis' hands, Einstein shook his head so hard that his floppy ears made a flapping noise.
"Maybe on the pads of his feet," Nora said.
"No," Travis said, even as Einstein barked once.
"When I found him, his feet were bleeding from a lot of hard travel. I had to clean out the wounds with boric acid. I'd have noticed a mark on one of his paws."
Again, Einstein shook his head violently, flapping his ears.
Travis said, "Maybe on the inner lip. They tattoo racehorses on the inner lip to identify them and prevent ringers from being run.
Let me peel back your lips and have a look, boy."
Einstein barked once,
"No,"
and shook his head violently.
At last, Travis got the point. He looked in the right ear and found nothing. But in the left ear, he saw something. He urged the dog to go with him to the window where the light was better, and he discovered that the mark consisted of two numbers, a dash, and a third number tattooed in purple ink on the pink-brown flesh. 33-9. Looking over Travis's shoulder, Nora said, "They probably had a lot of pups they were experimenting with, from different litters, and they had to be able to identify them."
"Jesus, if I'd taken him to a vet, if the vet had been told to look for a retriever with a tattoo..."
"But he has to have shots."
"Maybe he's already had them,"
Travis said, hopefully.
"We don't dare count on that. He was a lab animal in a controlled environment where he might not have needed shots, and maybe the usual inoculations would have interfered with their experiments."
"We can't risk a vet."
"If they do find him," Nora said, "we simply won't give him up."
"They can make us," Travis said worriedly.
"Damned if they can."
"Damned if they can't. More likely than not, the government's financing the research, and they can crush us."
"We can't risk it.
More than anything else, Einstein's afraid of going back to the lab."
"Yes, yes, yes."
"But," Nora said,
"if he contracts rabies or distemper or..."
"We'll get him the shots later," Travis said.
"Later, when the situation cools down, when he's not so hot."
The retriever whined happily, nuzzling Travis's neck and face in a sloppy display of gratitude. Frowning, Nora said,
"Einstein is about the number one miracle of the 20th century. You really think he's ever going to cool down? That they'll ever stop looking for him?"
"They might not stop for years," Travis admitted, stroking the dog. "But gradually they'll begin to search with less enthusiasm and less hope. And the vets will start forgetting to look in the ears of every retriever that's brought to them. Until then, he'll have to go without the shots, I guess. It's the best thing we can do. It's the only thing we can do."
Ruffling Einstein's coat with one hand, Nora said,
"I hope you're right."
"I am."
"I hope so."
"I am."
Travis was badly shaken by how close he had come to risking Einstein's freedom. And for the next few days, he brooded about the infamous Cornell curse. Maybe it was happening all over again. His life had been turned around and made livable because of the love he felt for Nora, and for this impossible damn dog.
and now maybe fate, which had always dealt with him in a supremely hostile manner, would rip both Nora and the dog away from him. He knew that fate was only a mythological concept. He did not believe there was actually a pantheon of malevolent gods looking down on him through a celestial keyhole and plotting tragedies for him to endure. Yet he could not help looking warily at the sky now and then. Each time he said something even slightly optimistic about the future, he found himself knocking on wood to counter malicious fates. At dinner, when he toppled the salt shaker, he immediately picked up a pinch of the stuff to throw it over his shoulder, then felt foolish and dusted it off his fingers. But his heart began to pound, and he was filled with a ridiculous, superstitious dread, and he didn't feel right again until he snatched up more salt and tossed it behind him. Although Nora was surely aware of Travis's eccentric behavior, she had the good grace to say nothing about his jitters. Instead, she countered his mood by quietly loving him every minute of the day, by speaking with great delight about their trip to Vegas, by being in unrelievedly good humor, and by not knocking on wood. She did not know about his nightmares because he did not tell her about them. It was the same bad dream, in fact, two nights in a row. In the dream, he was wandering in the wooded canyons of the Santa Ana foothills of Orange County, the same woods in which he had first met Einstein. He had gone there with Einstein again, and with Nora, but now he had lost them. Frightened for them, he plunged down steep slopes, scrambled up hills, struggled through clinging brush, calling frantically for Nora, for the dog. Sometimes he heard Nora answering or Einstein barking, and they sounded as if they were in trouble. So he turned in the direction from which their voices came. But each time he heard them, they were farther off and in a different place, and no matter how intently he listened or how fast he made his way through the forest, he was losing them, until he woke, breathless, heart racing, a silent scream caught in his throat. Friday, August 6th, was such a blessedly busy day that Travis had little time to worry about hostile fate. First thing in the morning, he telephoned a wedding chapel in Las Vegas, and using his American Express number, made arrangements for a ceremony on Wednesday, August 11th at 11 o'clock. Overcome by a romantic fever, he told the chapel manager that he wanted 20 dozen red roses, 20 dozen white carnations, a good organist, no damn taped music, who could play traditional music, so many candles that the altar would be bright without harsh electric light, a bottle of Dom Perignon with which to conclude events, and a first-rate photographer to record the nuptials. When those details had been agreed upon, he telephoned the Circus Circus Hotel in Las Vegas, which was a family-oriented enterprise that boasted recreational vehicle campgrounds behind the hotel itself. He arranged for camp space beginning the night of Sunday, August 8th. With another call to an RV campgrounds in Barstow, he also secured reservations for Saturday night, when they would pull off the road halfway to Vegas. Next, he went to a jewelry store, looked at their entire stock, and finally bought an engagement ring with a big, flawless 3-carat diamond, and a wedding band with 12 quarter-carat stones. With the rings hidden under the seat of the truck, Travis and Einstein went to Nora's house, picked her up, and took her to an appointment with her attorney, Garrison Dilworth.
"Getting married, that's wonderful," Garrison said, pumping Travis's hand.
He kissed Nora on the cheek. He seemed genuinely delighted.
"I've asked around about you, Travis."
Surprised, Travis said,
"You have? For Nora's sake."
The attorney's statement made Nora blush and protest, but Travis was pleased that Garrison had been concerned about her welfare. Fixing Travis with a measured stare, the silver-haired attorney said,
"I gather you did quite well in real estate before you sold your business."
"I did all right," Travis confirmed modestly, feeling as if he were speaking with Nora's father, trying to make the right impression.
"Very well," Garrison said. "And I also hear you've invested the profits rather well."
"I'm not broke," Travis admitted. Smiling, Garrison said, "I also hear you're a good, reliable man, with more than your share of kindness." It was Travis's turn to blush. He shrugged. To Nora, Garrison said,
"Dear, I'm delighted for you, happier than I can say."
"Thank you." Nora favored Travis with a loving, radiant look that made him want to knock on wood for the first time all day. Because they intended to take a honeymoon of at least a week or 10 days following the wedding,
Nora did not want to have to rush back to Santa Barbara in the event her real estate agent found a taker for Violet Devon's house. She asked Garrison Dilworth to draw up a power of attorney, giving him authority to handle all aspects of such a sale in her name during her absence. This was done in less than half an hour, signed and witnessed. After another round of congratulations and best wishes, they were on their way to buy a travel trailer. They intended to take Einstein with them, not only to the wedding in Vegas, but on the honeymoon. Finding good, clean motels that would accept a dog might not always be easy where they were going, so it was prudent to take a motel on wheels with them. Furthermore, neither Travis nor Nora could have made love with the retriever in the same room. "It'd be like having another person there," Nora said, blushing as bright as a well-polished apple. Staying in motels, they would have to rent two rooms, one for them and one for Einstein, which seemed too awkward. By 4 o'clock, they found what they were looking for. A middle-sized, silvery, Quonset-shaped Airstream with a kitchenette, a dining nook, a living room, one bedroom, and one bath. When they retired for the night, they could leave Einstein in the front of the trailer and close the bedroom door after themselves. Because Travis's pickup was already equipped with a good trailer hitch, they were able to hook the Airstream to the rear bumper and haul it with them as soon as the sale was concluded. Einstein, riding in the pickup between Travis and Nora, kept craning his head around to look out the back window at the gleaming semi-cylindrical trailer, as if amazed at the ingenuity of humankind. They shopped for trailer curtains, plastic dishes and drinking glasses, food with which to stock the kitchenette cabinets, and a host of other items they needed before they hit the road. By the time they returned to Nora's house and cooked omelets for a late dinner, they were dragging. For once, there was nothing smart-ass about Einstein's yawns. It was just tired. That night, at home in his own bed, Travis slept the deep, deep sleep of ancient petrified trees and dinosaur fossils. The dreams of the previous two nights were not repeated. Saturday morning, they set out on their journey to Vegas and to matrimony. Seeking to travel mostly on wide, divided highways on which they would be comfortable with the trailer, they took Route 101 south and then east until it became Route 134, which they followed until it became Interstate 210, with the city of Los Angeles and its suburbs to the south of them, and the Great Angeles National Forest to the north. Later, on the vast Mojave Desert, Nora was thrilled by the barren yet hauntingly beautiful panoramas of sand, stone, tumbleweed, mesquite, Joshua trees, and other cacti. The world, she said, suddenly seemed much bigger than she had ever realized, and Travis took pleasure in her bedazzlement. Barstow, California was a sprawling pit stop in that enormous wasteland, and they arrived at the big RV campgrounds by 3 that afternoon. Frank and Mae Jordan, the middle-aged couple in the next camper space, were from Salt Lake City, and were traveling with their pet, a black Labrador named Jack. To Travis's and Nora's surprise, Einstein had a terrific time playing with Jack. They chased each other around the trailers, took playful nips at each other, tangled and tumbled and sprang up and went chasing again. Frank Jordan tossed a red rubber ball for them, and they sprinted after it, vying to be the champion retriever. The dogs also made a game of trying to get the ball away from each other, and then holding on to it as long as possible. Travis was exhausted just watching them. Einstein was undoubtedly the smartest dog in the world, the smartest dog of all time, a phenomenon, a miracle, as perceptive as any man. But he was also a dog. Sometimes Travis forgot this fact, but he was charmed every time Einstein did something to remind him. Later, after sharing charcoal-grilled hamburgers and corn on the cob with the Jordans, and after downing a couple of beers in the clear desert night, they said goodbye to the Salt Lakers, and Einstein seemed to say goodbye to Jack. Inside the Airstream, Travis petted Einstein on the head and told him, "That was very nice of you." The dog cocked his head, staring at Travis as if to ask what the devil he meant. Travis said, "You know what I'm talking about, Furface."
"I know, too," Nora said. She hugged the dog. "When you were playing games with Jack, you could have made a fool of him if you'd wanted to. But you let him win his share, didn't you?"
Einstein panted and grinned happily. After one last nightcap, Nora took the bedroom, and Travis slept on the fold-out sofa bed in the living room.
Travis had thought about sleeping with her, and perhaps she had considered allowing him into her bed. After all, the wedding was less than 4 days away. God knew Travis wanted her.